Welcome to Symptomatic Redness, a podcast for those who are pathologically interested in history, critical theory, philosophy, aesthetics, or anything that may inform the modern world.
This is part 3 of 5 of my final conversation with the Moog Zahu. Why are we ending this show?
We talked a lot about, you know, the non-answers that SR led us to, the incompatibility. In some ways, you know, I'm going to talk about this on a future podcast on a different show that I'm going to be restarting. For those of you who don't know, and actually, Amug discovered me through this podcast. Was it Diet Soap? Which one did you listen to the most of?
No, actually, it was neither of those. It was From Alpha to Omega.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I'm always on Alpha to Omega. I'm usually in their reading groups, right? But
yes.
Alpha to Omega, though, started off as sort of the Irish equivalent of, not of Diet Soap, but had a similar aesthetic and goal. And you could tell that, yes, Tom was influenced by Doug's early work.
Diet Soap feels very much like the podcast for a lot of us.
Actually. Yeah. Well, the thing is, all this stuff is largely kind of irrelevant now because the left podcast scene, which is overstated in its importance, I think.
We'll know that for sure when Biden wins.
Yeah. Jesus. The left podcast scene is just not – it's kind of divorced from its own history. You know, the earliest left podcasts were actually mostly Pacifica radio shows in Democracy Now!, you know, like –
yeah.
In the early Bush years, I remember listening to like Doug Henwood and, well, not early Bush years because podcasts weren't around in the early Bush years, but like 2006, 2007, 2008, 2009. So the end of the Bush, beginning of the Obama years. First, I listened to Democracy Now! Like on like internet radio. Then I would listen to it on podcast. Right. And then I would also listen to Pacifica radio shows. And the biggest one, which is still around, is Doug Henwood's show. Then I found Diet Soap because most at the time, and actually opposite of the trend now, most of the left podcast shows were immediate issues driven. They were, you know, activists, immediate stuff, quasi news. You know, the most theoretical show was Henwood's, and it wasn't that theoretical, but he would always interview an author.
And now it's, I mean, I wouldn't say it's theoretical, it's definitely more theoretical, but it's largely internal score settling.
Right. It's internal score setting, or it's basically recorded book groups, which, you know, yes, I'm a part of. Like, you know, like I do that for From Alpha to America. Literally, we record a book group.
And sometimes the recorded book groups and the internal score settling are not two different things.
No, they're really not. But if you look at a podcast like Red Menace, which I think is tangentially related to Rev Left Radio.
Red Menace is the Dasher and Anna Kachian, right? Is that them? Or that's Red Scare.
That's Red Scare. Yeah. Red Menace is like Allison Escalante and I think Brett from Red Left Radio, I think. Red Scare is a different kind of podcast, which no one will talk crap about, but everybody talks crap about constantly.
Yes, yes.
So I'm just going to go on air and say, everybody, I've actually never listened to a full episode. I've listened to some of the promos.
I found it somewhat
alienating, but I guess more not, I didn't hear much of their politics. I found their humor somewhat alienating. So
I
wrote that off as a personal taste preference issue. I also like don't find Chapo funny, for example.
No, I don't anymore either.
Like, well, I kind of never did because, like, the people they would make fun of, like, you know, this is going to sound really elitist of me, but, like, I when I always engaged with conservatives, I would never waste time to hit below the belt and listen to people who I thought were stupid. So, like, why would I go to make fun of these, like, right-wing media figures when I had contempt for them? The only time I broke that rule is when everybody made me fucking care about Jordan Peterson.
Yes.
Which I resented, yeah, by the way, deeply, that I was made to care about Jordan Peterson. Like, I would rather tackle someone like George Packer, who I think is actually smart. Or
George Packer, the liberal New York Times guy.
Yeah. Someone like Murray Rothbard, who's dead, but is actually a real influence on things intellectually, and who is also actually smart and has a counter-narrative of history, that if you are into it, a lot of the left engagements do not truly deal with. because they don't go deep enough to know that these guys have constructed an alternate narrative. In a way, they learn to do that from, like, Marxist, you know, historiography. I don't even think Rothbart would deny that. So, but even, like, this, there's this obsession with, like, the intellectual far right and fascist right. Outside of Carl Schmitt, I don't think most of those people are relevant.
Yes. Like, and it's also that, as we stated last time, it's unclear that they're really best seen as, like, conservatives.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know that we live in a conservative moment right now either. I think we live in a right-wing moment, which is a different thing.
Yes.
And I contend increasingly that the left is also in a right-wing moment and is completely unaware of it because it is settling its standards in opposition to Trump. And for a broad appeal, it is dropping certain things that it used to care about. And I don't just mean that of the Rachel Maddow, you know, radical liberal, left liberal crowd. I also mean like leftists have softened stances on things that during the Obama years, they would have never softened.
Civil liberties stuff,
opposition to war, because, you know, they're like Trump is actually kind of keeping us out of war. Criticism of the welfare state, which we also used to be much better on, like that it wasn't good enough.
Yes.
I mean, I actually like there's been three articles Jacobin's published in the last like 4 or 5 months that almost made me just completely stop. I mean, I don't give him money anyway, but completely stop reading them.
Like the UBI article, I think is one of
them. Well, the UBI article, like, here's the thing with Amber Frost analysis, or Amber Ailey, excuse me. Some of that's right, but then I don't understand Amber's own politics. Because a lot of what she says about UBI and that criticism would also apply to any welfare statism. And the analogy to the patriarchy kind of holds and kind of doesn't. And, like, they're not opting to get rid of the state either. So what is actually going on there? You know, like, it's not – it's – and then there's this
– I mean, there's the labor movement, right? That's the sort of magic solver for a lot of them.
But it's what labor movement?
The one that will be created when the DSA does its job right.
I mean, like, there is a labor movement. We have seen more strikes recently. That's utterly predictable with normal economic patterns because we're not in a downturn, by the way.
Right.
Because it's because there's less.
But they don't mean that. They mean like some other thing.
They mean like the labor political movement as opposed to the labor strike movement or whatever.
Right. I mean, even the strike movement isn't up to what they would like it to be in order for their achievements to be protected in a future Sanders administration or whatever.
Well, but here's the thing, and I never understood this about the DSA. These people should arguably understand law, right? Since they, you know, want to use the institutions of the state to theoretically weaken and dissolve parts of the state. Their analogy on like their, I'm going to use a trot term that I think is, well, it's not just a trot term, it's an old Marxist term too. A Bonapartist view of the executive, you know, the pink executive, right? They believe that the party will just pivot based off of an electoral win in the executive. That hasn't even happened under Trump.
Well, they don't think. I mean, this is again the magic solver. It's not just Bernie. It's going to be this magic movement, right?
Right,
this
but there's no empirical evidence so far that like outside of literally. Places that are high ethnic minority enclaves, which has led to a strong debate within the DSA itself between the workerist and the identity-driven people. And the identity-driven people actually have a strategic point. Outside of Brooklyn and California and Seattle, the only ways that they've been able to get people who are really like socialist-friendly on the far end of the progressive spectrum, Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, etc., is liberal ethnic enclaves.
Yes, no, I totally agree with you. But I think the thought is not that there exists such a movement, but it's this sort of hypothetical claim that like the best vehicle for that movement is going to be, you know, through union DSA filters, right?
Right.
And that's not a claim. So it's not as if people are everybody, you know, on the Amber wing of what, I mean, I don't want to make this all about her, are not aware of the things that you're saying. The thought is just that, you know, that this movement is what we want to get.
Right.
And the way we,
it's still the catch-22 because, for example, one of the things they need for their movement to ever happen is for Bernie's reforms of the Taft-Hartley Act to go through, which he's only really started talking about in the last year, right?
Yes.
He's talked about it before, but like actually have like a legislative agenda that would deal with it. Guess what, though? He would not be in the executive, not in the place to enact such a legislative agenda, which means they're dependent on the movement to get the movement that they need to be dependent on. Like, it is literally a circular or a burrow snake eating its tail, because they're like they know they need certain reforms for certain things to happen, but they also already need to have legislative power to do that. And they're using a model of executive power based off of what Republicans do, but Republicans actually, their interests are more clearly in areas that have been abrogated over the last 150 years to the executive, whereas none of the areas in which the socialists would operate within the Democratic Party have been abrogated to the executive. There is no way that the executive can dominate internal trade policy.
I think it's unfair to say that it's all executive focused. It's kind of more vague than that, right? The thought is something like,
then why throw so much behind the Bernie campaign in specific?
Well, I think they think it's going to have this motivational effect rather than like the aim is to build the movement rather than achieve anything, at least in the first term.
Using the executive for that is terrible, because when the executive fails, who's going to take the blame for it? The non-existent non-movement. Maybe you're right that I'm being unfair, but like from everything that I look at this is where it's specific, it's what I'm saying, and where it's vague, it's a catch-22. All right, you have calls to abolish the Senate so you can have more fair representation. Who the fuck's going to abolish the Senate before you have more fair representation? I mean, like, also, before you deal with the states, that's stupid.
I think the core of the issue is that, you know, there's a bunch of this stuff that is just good stuff, which is supposed to happen after you get the movement. And then there are kind of non-existent non-strategies to get the movement going. And I think that's the problem. So, for instance, abolishing the Senate doesn't strike me as like a horrible thing. You know?
No, but it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, what could happen is like Medicare for All, but you're going to get the Ezra Klein Cory Booker version, not the Bernie version, with some Bernie-esque compromises thrown into it, which admittedly would be better than what Obama did, which is the starting off from the compromise point, but that's what you're going to get.
But, you know, you might argue that there would just be a bigger backlash, you know, just as with Obama, we have Trump, with Bernie, we'll have someone even worse, or, you know, the pendulum will swing, you know.
Well, so that's almost assuredly the case. Honestly, this election's pivotal for the left, but almost anything that any outcome that happens is not actually really good for them in a game theory scenario. All right, let's go through the options. Trump wins against Biden. Okay, they can continue doing what they're doing.
But then, you know, demoralization is going to set in pretty quickly, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
And people will be opened up for the people. You know, people are already. I'm pretty happy to compromise with whatever Democratic candidate comes up. You know,
I mean,
they will be even more so.
The number of progressives willing to compromise with, for example, a number of progressives and like the right wing of the socialist movement. And I don't mean Nas Bull or anything like that. I just mean like, you know, economically less ambitious.
Yes.
They're already softening up to Warren.
And a number of them, and a number of people who are, you know, hardcore anti-Trump are pretty happy with Biden now. Those two numbers are really going to increase in 2024. Jesus Christ.
And also if you look at historical trends, yes. Okay, so I was actually looking at this the other day, trying to understand, doing some conventional bourgeois political analysis, right? As opposed to like my Marxist class theory of things, which is also helpful, but when you consider that most of this is not really involving the working class anyway, we can't really say that there's a Marxist answer to this. But the insider outsider candidate, not the true outsider, but the insider outsider candidate, and the Democratic Party is generally favored to win the nomination.
That's Warren this time, I'd say.
Right. However, and in those years, the Democrats have won, but those people have always pivoted center every single time.
Yes.
In fact, you know, some of them started off as center, like the Clintons, you know, against the Mondo establishment, Obama against the Clinton establishment. That's happened. A Carter against the
Gary Hart. He was actually left of Gary Hart.
Yeah, Carter against Gary Hart was the beginning of the Clinton move. Honestly,
right, right. Dukakis.
Dukakis was, you know, like
Jackson.
So in those years, what happens? The Democrats historically are as likely to nominate the establishment as they are an outsider, but the establishment right. Democratic candidate historically, since Lyndon Johnson, has lost every single time. But so that's amazing.
So if Biden wins, you think he'll be likely to lose?
It's hard to say because there is demographic shifts in certain places, but given the place where the only swing reddish state that the Democrats strongly stand to win is North Carolina or Arizona, I think.
And the people who are in the tank for Biden are going to. I mean, I don't know
that they're going to come out in force in those areas. And also you need people to come out in force in the upper Midwest that fell to Trump.
Yeah.
And don't trust the Democratic establishment, even though they're labor voters.
Yes. They're not, I mean, there's a debate to be had about whether they would come out for Bernie, but there's no debate, I think, with Biden, I'd say.
Right. So
they're not going to come out. Yeah.
So, I mean, Trump could still lose the election. He stands a better chance of losing than any other president than George W. Bush. But let's remind ourselves, George W. Bush actually legitimately won a second election.
Yes. Let me put it this way. I think it is unlikely that Biden will – I don't think Biden will do better than Hillary. I'll say that much.
Also, Biden's not as good of a retail politician as Hillary, which is saying something. So, I mean, Biden's been given the gaffes. I've known about Biden's gaffing since I was a kid. But let's just say that all this happens. Let's say that Bernie gets the nomination because right now he's pulling high again. But, you know, the other issue right now that why Biden stands to win is Bernie and Warren divide the progressive caucus, even though and the socialist vote, kind of. Even though they actually don't pull from the same people, like at all, yes. Interestingly.
Yeah.
I was reading that Bernie actually pulls more from Biden voters, which was interesting.
Not all that surprising, but...
Well, I mean, if you look at the age and maleness, then no, it isn't surprising. But if you look at the class politics, it's totally surprising. So it's hard to say. Now, all this conventional analysis is just to say, though, that like... This is a long shot anyway.
Yeah.
There seems to be a fundamental overstatement of the pool these people have. Like, the you know, people of the squad, right? But that's four freshman Congress people. You know, like, do the math on that. That's tiny.
Here's maybe a way of phrasing the question. It's like, are things really, really, really fundamentally different other than rhetorically than they were in 2004? To be clear, I was saying kind of on a lot of the stuff we're saying right now, we could easily have been having this conversation. I mean, even though it was about, I don't know, a Dean victory, right? And I know they were all much more centrist, but like a lot of what we're saying now is kind of just, you know, copy paste from conversations people on the left were having about the Democrats back then.
Yeah, it's
And
I'm old enough to remember it. I was part of those conversations.
Right. Kucinich was the guy back then.
I was a Kucinich supporter, maybe. Oh, no, I voted for a third party back then. But, like,
sympathetic to Kucinich.
But I was sympathetic to Kucinich because he was, like, I was actually coming out of my right-wing phase, but he was, like, pretty thoroughly anti-war. And so, like, I was like, okay, well, that's what we got. It was, like, for me, it was, like, Kucinich and, like, Jerry Brown or something. I mean, like, the Libertarian candidate. I don't remember who it was for that year.
Yeah. But I mean, the thought is we'd have the same conversation, except the causes then were different, right? But the thought is we have the same conversation that we're having now about Taft-Hartley, but with, you know, militarism and Iraq war drawdowns, where it's like, oh, if the good candidate gets in, there isn't that much, you know, all the sort of supposed anti-Iraq war sentiment will evaporate.
And the other thing is that is a good analogy to 2004 is 2004 was a recovery period. And we've been in a slow and not a much more less diffuse recovery period. But 2004 recovery also didn't like recover for most people. I mean, that was the beginning of that trend, began in the 90s, where like recovery just hasn't trickled down at all.
Right. The reason I bring this up is just because 2004 is supposed to be this, you know, or not 2004 specifically, but it's a date which is before the whole left-wing revival, financial crisis, et cetera, et cetera. So intuitively, if you grown up listening to leftist podcasts, you'd think the political situation is like really completely different from 2004, right?
But we're not really like, even though we talk about economic issues more instead of foreign policy issues, which again, in some ways, the focus on the executive with foreign policy in 2004 was more coherent. That's something in the executive control. But what's changed now is the nature of the left-wing movement has kind of changed. But as we go on, it hasn't. So, for example, what I was going to say that was a breaking point wasn't the Amber A. Lee article, which I admittedly is enormous. I mean, there's some stuff at the end of that, if you read it closely, can read as like a defense of economic nationalism and like strong borders.
Right. That's a running issue for any social democrat, you'd say.
Right. Like that's something that all social democrats kind of like hope you don't notice that they're not entirely coherent on, right? But what the one that got me was that there was this apologia for the New Deal.
I'm surprised that wasn't earlier, by the way. Why that isn't, you know, repeatedly done?
Well, I mean, they do stuff about it every now and then. But them saying that it had no the argument was that it had no role in segregation. Or actually, they said, no, the New Deal didn't cause segregation, which is true. It didn't. But that it had no role is just a lie. Like, FDR FDR had to keep the Dixiecrats in his coalition. And like, I knew racist Dixiecrats who were alive in the 30s when I lived in Georgia, particularly in the 80s, who were Republicans, but they still had FDR, who were Republicans after the 70s, but they still had FDR's fucking picture on their wall. And I'm not kidding. Like, that's not the, like, people tend to read the Southern strategy as altering that politics in a way that it did and didn't.
But it seems like the sense I'm getting from your remarks is that things, you know, at least in terms of the, like, if we zoom out outside, like, certain changes in, like, the left scene and the cultural and social power that it projects, I don't think things have changed at all.
No, really. our rhetoric has spread throughout the larger media sphere. That's
and the
true.
Underlying media here.
Yeah, that's true. Right. Like I would listen to Slate podcasts who would like, you know, where some of their hosts were against gay marriage even in like 2006, and they were Democrats, right. Who were now like openly, you know, using gender non-binary pronouns and stuff like that, because that's where right. Our cultural norms have moved, and the left continues to be somewhat successful on those.
Right.
But interestingly enough, we all kind of realize that the cultural norms is not what we need to win, even for like, you know, identity issues, frankly.
But not only that, this whole like past 10 years or 11 years of leftist revival has been like premised on a recognition that the cultural issues aren't that important, right? Like that's what this whole thing was about.
Except no one actually believes that. We still all culture war.
Right.
But that's our, you know, dominant mode of expression.
But you agree with me that that's what, like, that was the sort of line in the sand that we drew, right? It was like,
well, yeah, like a more diverse elite is just a more diverse elite. It doesn't actually change them. I mean, even for people of color, it doesn't really change their lives. That was my whole argument.
Right. And that was something that we supposedly learned after Occupy and the
Fascists. We didn't learn shit.
But I mean, look, I agree with you. I'm just saying that there is a bunch of literature which said this.
Right. Like, yeah, the 1% rhetoric, the return to like economic populism amongst the left.
Right. And blamed and kind of invented this revisionist history, which was like before 2008, no one talked about economic issues. And no one like explicitly tried to engage with the Democrats and push them further left. And now we're going to start doing that.
Right. Coming off and out of the early disillusionment about Obama.
And so in 2015, we kind of started from ground zero, where it was like Jesse Jackson was forgotten or like rechristened, you know, Howard Dean was forgotten. All that stuff is kind of just completely swept under the rug. And, you know, we have this periodization where, you know, good labor movement before 70s, after 70s, neoliberalism is winning and Democrats give up, which is kind of true.
Let's talk about the much ado about generational politics, because the other thing that everyone in America likes to talk about is that, like, generational politics doesn't matter.
Right.
And I actually somewhat agree. I think a lot of the generational politics is actually a proxy for accumulated wealth, although there is cultural norm differences. A lot of this is millennials flattering themselves in the way that boomers flattered themselves, frankly, because notice that history starts with their memory.
What would you say? So millennials are kind of 1980 onwards, are they?
So formally the definition, it depends on which definition you read. I think the most current accepted one starts in 82, which means I don't count. Some of them start as early as 78. So like there's actually these generations that are considered like micro niche generations that I'm part of that are like the Zoomials. Right. And like I'm probably the Zoomers that are like in like seniors in high school right now are going to be up there also their own micro niche generation.
Right. So I'm 96. So I'm in between Zoomer and Millennial, I think.
Right. And Millennial ends somewhere between 96 and 2000. Honestly. So who knows? Right.
Right.
But the thing is, like, one, if you look at those generational cohorts, there's a big damn difference between, say, someone who's 33 and someone who's 27 in their memory and cultural knowledge and how they were affected by the recession. And two, like, there are, for a lot of people, their politicization, if they're millennial, started with Occupy, which I have a much more cynical narrative of than people seem to know.
Well, I'm surprised by that, but go on.
People who listen to Pop the Left know my cynical narrative, but I always thought Occupy was the death of a political movement, not the birth of a new one, which I still kind of think. I think what we saw is the Marxist revival and the socialist revival really comes out of Occupy's like failure to do much. Yeah. And that style of politics was easily like it goes all the way back to like the late 1990s, because Occupy very much for me felt like the battle for Seattle. And, you know, I wasn't like instrumental in planning either, like not to make myself important. I was barely at Zuccotti Park. I went there afterwards. I was mostly involved in Occupy Seoul and Occupy Yoido. But I was there, and I went to also Occupy Oakland stuff too when I was in the Bay visiting a friend. So I was just sort of an observer who saw it, you know, saw it post facto and talked to people and kind of was involved, you know, tangentially, right? But I really was like the only time I'd ever gone to the West Coast before I was 19 years old was to drive to go directly to the battle for Seattle. And we literally drove like four damn days to get there. And the feel of that politics where, you know, like Pat Buchanan was at the battle for Seattle and Alec Jones was involved with Occupy Austin. You know, like that sort of like broad, you know, collaborationist politics sort of represented by like Counterpunch with strong anarchist element. That's all really a thing of like the reaction to the failure of the first New Left.
Right. You know?
And that kind of really kicks up steam in the late 90s and the anti-globalization movement.
Right. And it's those guys who you're saying died at Occupy.
I believe so.
Which is really sad because, I mean, so here's a reason that like a lot of people aren't worried about that, right? Because they think that they died because they evolved into the essayers. But if what we're saying is right, it's that wasn't an evolution. That was just, you know, different.
So what happened, you know, some of them did become DSAers. You think of like Naomi Klein, who was heavily involved in that. It's now like, you know, on our side, quote unquote, right? But I also pointed out to people that Jacobin Magazine's branding aside and their relationship to Bernie Sanders aside, DSA was always the most right-wing of the left-wing movements. It was explicitly a class collaborationist. Harringtonism, which is not popular in the DSA anymore, even amongst this right-wing, was it kind of thought the labor movement was dead. It was not third-wayism, mm-hmm. You know, of the Clinton, even Bill Bradley variety. But it was it saw the dissolution of the SPA and the dissolution of the Trotskyist parties as, you know, and the defeat of the union movement and like the Camejo Greens not being successful, which was the kind of red green Greens who, you know, a mixture of Trotskyists and Maoists that kind of tried to start their own movement in the whatever incarnation of the North Star magazine that it was. that movement, in which went into the Green Party eventually, had all kind of failed, and the DSA had been around for all that. But the DSA in the 90s and 2000s was like people who were kind of like in the progressive left, like Barbara Ehrenreich. They were Marxists, but they were really quiet about it, you know, like Cornel West, you know. Mm-hmm. And they were like, they were particularly at that time on better terms with the Democratic establishment than they were later. And then Jacobin emerges out of Dissent Magazine, really. And Bashir Sankara's like relationship to the DSA, and also comes around when that Boney momentum comes, and that really explodes. And Jacobin was interesting because it was always more radical in its, you know, aesthetics than it was in its content. Like, they, I mean, early Jacobin magazine were like critiquing Marx in defense of Keynesianism and stuff, like, and then defending Marx. I mean, they were always a kind of pluralist publication, and to be fair, that's still true. But it was, they were careful of what you could say. So, like, certain kinds of Trotskyists could get in there, but other kinds couldn't.
And this is the DSA still.
No, the Jacobin, which is not an organ of the DSA, but its editor was, you know, the DSA, and that's what funneled people towards the DSA. That and the relationship, that's why that's the organ that blew up. If you remember, like we talked about this in the last episode, I thought the IWW, because it was beginning to actually do labor activism again, although in a limited form, was going to be the organ that blew up. I was wrong. The IWW is still growing, I think, compared to what it has historically been, and it is still doing more labor organizing, although in very progressive areas like Portland.
But it's not blown up nearly as much as Jacobin.
No, it has not grown up nearly as much as the DSA. The problem with the DSA, though, and we talked about this last time too, is we have no idea what its actual numbers are. It's very hard to get off the rolls once you've paid. I can tell you, like, the Salt Lake chapter is technically like 350 people, but, like, active involvement's only probably a fifth to a tenth of that, because it has a very low barrier to entry. You just pay, you know, your local dues, and you pay like, I don't know, $20 a year or something. It's not even that much. And I think their dues are going to go up, but like, that's where they're at. But they've also slowed down in growth precipitously. Like, they went from like the cap for socialist movements after the 70s was usually about 6,000 active members. I don't know why, but that tends to be where they all topped out at. DSA has hit 50-ish thousand sometime in the last year, but they're still quoting that number, meaning their membership has slowed. They might be at max capacity. And the SDS, which is the only organization that was ever that big on the left as a singular organization, which wasn't explicitly socialist, by the way, was about 80,000. Right. So, but that was a very campus group. That's what it was.
But just to be clear, so you're saying that. So the broader question is, how have things changed since 2004, right?
Yeah, or maybe even how have they changed since 1968?
Yes, yes.
I mean, the Soviet Union doesn't exist, so that's how they've changed.
Right.
So maybe that's too far to go back. I mean, even the New Left exists in the context of a Soviet Union and a China that's still arguably a communist, or attempting to, well, they never claimed to be communist, actually, but was attempting to be. Right. So that's a big difference, but...
So there's certainly a lot of, but to some extent that disaffiliation with communism was happening, already underway, and by 68 for a while.
Right, and I mean, in the sense that there were no, like, there were active Marxist groups outside of the ISO were super rare. Mm. You know, like you would meet them on the largest college campuses, but they were rare. Like, I was more likely to meet people interested in Crime Think or Z Communications or something, or postmodernist, you know, for the Gen Xer people who were actually very weary of any ideological commitment whatsoever.
Right. Maybe you might say this kind of like little tango we have with this sort of left had with the Democrats began in 68, you might think.
Yeah, well... It began the tango that the left has with the Democrats goes off and on all the way back to the end of third periodism.
Oh, but I'm saying maybe the specific kind of like 70s neoliberal tango.
Oh yeah, it probably goes back to the ability to want to break with them and to not want to break, like that debate by itself, for example, right? The debate about how we should relate to the Democratic Party. Those debates have not changed, even though we're not the same ideologies. So if you listen to Democracy Now! In like 2006, when Nancy Pelosi took the house, you know, took the house, right? You heard all these debates, like Amy Goodman was hosting them. And it would be like Norman, it would be like formal Maoists, like Norman Finkelstein debating with like somebody else. But it was the same, it was actually the same debate. So when you look at all this history, I mean, in the context of this show, that what one of the things that has changed is there's been a left-wing culture industry, and I'm going to call that for what it is. It's a business for a while.
Right.
A lot of the party imprints, I could talk about the history of Verso. The history of Verso, you know, Verso started off as New Left Press. It was originally splintered from the New York Review, which had, I think, an explicit relationship to the SWP.
Right.
It became increasingly independent, I think, in the late 80s, early 90s. Rebranded itself as Verso. But it originally even had the SWP's like obsessions, like this, like their weird mixture of Trotskyism and like Althusserian Maoism that they published and were interested in. Theoretically, that was the interest of the head cadres of the SWP, which was like, you know, this non-dialectical new alternative to analytic Marxism that still
has still some, heavily influenced by contemporary social science.
Right, although. Or it sounded like it was, and it sounded objective, you know, like, you know, but wasn't really, and like also was kind of like could play with postmodernism and Foucauldianism and stuff, you know, like, so that was actually sort of, you know, if you know anything about Alice Kalinikos and like the old, the, you know, like the 80s, 90s, aughts, SWP, that was their obsessions. And you see that reflected in New Left Review / Verso's printing. They would also print like Mandelite economic texts, you know. Frankfurt School stuff, and engagements with postmodernists because that would sell in academia and keep the press alive. It rebranded itself as Verso. I don't know when, but Verso, but I think by the mid to late 90s, Verso was a business.
Right.
Its distributor and owner now is like it's tied into Random House.
So this left-wing culture industry, is it? How is it related to this tango with the Democrats? That
well, let's look at the dissolution of the ISO. ISO is dead now. It doesn't exist. It's the second now of the IS parties to of the Tony Cliffite parties to go up. They were the most popular parties of Trotskyists in the English speaking world for a long time. Weirdly, like sympathetic to social democracy and left communism, like just broadly eclectic in the way they in their theoretical interests. So one of those presses becomes Verso. The other press becomes Haymarket Book. Well, Haymarket Book, even when it was under the under a, it's never been technically a formal thing of the ISO, but it is tied into it in like key ways. Its board of directors was largely from ISO membership. It's run by a nonprofit group that was directly related to the ISO as an organ. And the rape scandal that finally brought the ISO down really like one, the ISO had been hemorrhaging membership in this decade like crazy.
So the ISO is like this case study for, you know, far left relationships.
We don't know how big it was. Estimates were that it was probably around 6,000 at its height in the 90s or whatever. I know tons of people who've come in and out of it, but it's like it was one of those groups, It and Salt, which is another quasi-Cliffite group, right? Were like the Trotskyist groups that you would meet people like, oh, I got burnt out by my left cadre group. I was either in SALT or I was in ISO. And one of the things about that is a lot of those people went into the DSA when the DSA came around. And I mean, I literally can think of podcast friends of mine that did that, even though they're not inclined to the DSA's politics.
Right.
The other thing that happened is Haymarket Books, in addition to running like the Serious Marxist Research series they worked with Brill with and like doing all the stuff that they used to, you know, publish for their what was clearly like an ISO like agenda populist press.
But started, we like Brill though, don't we?
Yeah. No, I mean I like their series, don't get me wrong. And Haymarket still exists. Haymarket survives the ISO. But Haymarket also started publishing people like Rebecca Solnit.
Yes.
Who isn't even like she's on the progressive spectrum, but like she was a Hillary supporter. So like, and well, you know what that did? They became worth a lot more money. Mm-hmm. So the internal, they put pressures in addition to the leadership, but the membership have been putting pressures on the ISO about the rape scandal. And I mean, I don't even think that was the first one.
Okay. Yeah.
For a long time, for at least four or five years. But it feels like the reason why it came up when it did is also the Haymarket book was worth a couple million dollars. And so they needed kind of like actual corporate nonprofit, you know, quasi-corporate, at least good nonprofit accountability processes outside of a party.
So that so that generalizes to outside this ISO context, right? This dynamic you're talking about.
Right. So what I'm talking about is I bring up Verso because Verso's history is similar, but didn't like take down the SWP. That was separate. Right. And I mean, I think the SWP still technically exists, but no one cares anymore. But, you know, the DSA has become like a clearinghouse for these groups who still pretty much believe the same things they did when they were sectarian individuals, but now they're all together in this organization that's very decentralized and has a hard time holding its national accountable to its locals, or its locals accountable to its national. Mm. Like, the locals have to have their charters approved by the national, and there are some issues that come up with that apparently increasingly lately. But in general, the locals can kind of do what they want. The nationals kind of do what it wants. And while the national does have delegates come up every few years at a convention and votes on things or whatever, they're not, it's not, there's no real party relationship. There's no recall. And so the reason why I bring this up though, is these small groups kind of dissolving into this bigger one can give this bigger one a sense of like being, you know, like a massive movement. But even at 50,000 paper members, and if you assumed even all of them were fairly active, a lot of cults are bigger. Like, I think at their height, the Raelians were 100,000 people. Like I just bring that up to put things in perspective. Right. Scientology is way larger than the DSA.
Yes, yes. So you're saying what? It's not a movement. It's like a consolidation.
It's a consolidation. It is a movement. There are new people in it. I'd probably say the consolidation of those groups, even if you looked at it,
is not a bad thing.
And also, like, well, I don't know. That's yet to be seen. But but it's not inherently a bad thing. And also, like, I think probably it's only about a tenth of the DSA's growth, probably. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the DSA's ideologies come out of this, and also, because we're in a right-wing mood, how people radicalize, and we've talked about this already, is instead of looking at left communism, which kind of makes it feel like there's nothing to be done. Mm-hmm. Like, if you act about left communist tactics, what are left communist tactics? Yes, like, Berdigist in Italy and the PCI, for example, have them, but most left communists do not. That's popular in a democratic administration where you feel like your allies are just not really your allies, right? But in a Republican administration, you can get this grand oppositional view, and it makes you. And what's funny is the right wing mirrors this too. Like the alt right, like Trump's actual relationship to the alt right, in so much that he has one, is part of why they are now basically just lone wolf terror cells instead of an actual movement. Which is not to say they're not dangerous, or even those lone wolf terror cells aren't growing. But like, But that's that. The movement has been hurt as an oppositionary movement. It's not oppositional power. You can look at Alex Jones.
Right. So you're saying that it's not as if there are two different groups, one of which is Democrat facing and one of which is more anarchisty. Rather, the best thing is the way to see it is that there are the dynamic movement is between kind of, you know, hegemony, Gramsci tactical talk in the Republican years and left com talk in the Democrat years.
Yeah. I mean, I think both things actually exist, honestly, but the rise
and fall correlates.
With, focus, they rhyme. Like the 2004 to 2020 rhyme. They rhyme.
Right.
It also felt like in the beginning of the Bush years that there was a massive and curdling anti-Bush movement. Bush was only super popular after 9/11, and that popularity waned within a year in the circles that I moved in. Like, for example, my college, to put it in perspective, Greg Palast, of all people, like, spoke to my college.
I don't know who that is.
Along one of the late progressive muck writers, like, works for The Guardian and Independent, used to be an American, very much in that old Democracy Now! Far left progressive, but not a Marxist, because that wasn't really a thing on the table.
Right.
He got him and the doctor. Doctor who was who Patch Adams is based off. I don't remember his name. I guess Adams, Dr. Adams, who endorsed him. They got booed at my college. Got booed off stage in 2001.
Why? Because I'm patriotic?
Yeah. Southern College, you know, the area is culturally conservative. By 2005, you know, we were moving to students were leading gender more inclusive language for making everything he or she when you wrote formally. I actually, in retrospect, think that like they is actually a step up from that, but whatever. Not just for the non-binary stuff. I mean, like that too, but also just ease of use.
And then you're saying, citing this as evidence that there was an anti-Bush mood.
Yeah, there was a huge anti-Bush mood. Like, right. And like these colleges that we think are super like progressive backgrounds kind of weren't at the time. And I think we overestimate how much they are now too, honestly. I was talking to J.G. Michael of Pelox Blues about this. He talks to a lot of kids at the colleges out in like Pennsylvania, and a lot of them are like nihilistic zoomers with like talking about the cucking of America. And what's funny about that in like 1999, I remember on college campuses, all these dude bros talking about the pussification of America.
Yeah. Fight Club.
Yeah. I mean, although Fight Club, interestingly, I'm going to give Palahniuk a credit, was actually a critique of that.
Right.
But that
wasn't the reception.
No, even though it's very shallow. But I mean, but you know, that's always the case, right? You make Taxi Driver, it's a critique of like vigilantism, and everyone thinks of celebrating it, or Scarface, or Falling Down. And even now, people misread those movies and think they're being progressive, talking about how racist they are. And maybe they are, but they're actually not presenting any of that sympathetically.
Yeah,
it is us who makes it so. So,
but it seems like there's this, you know, a lot of the stuff you said about Bush, you could say that there was an anti-Reagan movement.
Like, yeah, there was. I just don't remember. Yeah. Like, you can talk to Doug Lane about that. Like,
right.
Doug Lane was just old enough to be part of the anti-Reagan movement, but the anti-Gulf War I movement. You know,
yes.
Like, we all came out of that. And I went from left wing to right wing to left wing again through that, through those milieus.
Right.
Right now I feel like there's a false optimism because we are on the margins, there is more effect, in so much that more people are disenchanted with politics. But people, that disenchantment with politics narrative traits back to fucking Watergate.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like
trades back to Vietnam.
Yeah, I mean, like, this is a narrative that goes all the way back to the quote boomers unquote.
Yeah,
honestly, it goes back to the Korean War, although a lot of people are much more like sanguine about that. So what do we do? I mean, like, my big thing in pointing out, the more I've studied the left, is like all the stuff we think is new really comes from the middle of the 20th century, and it gets more murky once the Soviet Union falls. But it's never been clear.
We'd like to thank you for listening to today's episode. Symptomatic Redness and Alternatives are produced for Zero Books by the team of C. Derek Varn, J.G. Michael, Amog Sahu, and Toby Kamir, our ever-faithful producer and editor. Please keep following us on the Inside Zero Books Patreon account for additional episodes. Have a good day.